This is White Collared, the podcast, season 1, episode 10, Vital Signs. I would like to welcome you to this episode of White Collared, the podcast, which is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series White Collar. My name is Eric Altenglenn Hilliard. I have previously mentioned that this podcast uses enhanced features. What that means is that if you are using an appropriate podcast player, you can see images and websites appear at various times throughout the episode as they are relevant to what's being discussed. Unfortunately, if you are one of those people who are using the default player on your Android or Apple device, those players do not support these advanced features. If that is the case for you, and you would like to check out some of these enhancements, I would like to suggest that you take a look at a couple of alternative podcast players. On the Apple devices, take a look at Overcast. On Android devices, take a look at Podverse. These are recommended podcast players that support enhanced features and capabilities, and I think you will find that you like them. Give them a try. If you like them, great. Support the developers. And if not, hey, no harm done. I will have links to those podcast players and a couple others on the website. Now, let's get into the episode. Vital Signs first aired on February 2nd, 2010. It was written by Joan B. Weiss and directed by Denny Gordon. Neil learns that June's granddaughter is in need of a kidney transplant, but has inexplicably been taken off the donors list. June tells Neil that a woman approached her saying that her organization could help her granddaughter get the kidney she needs, while at the same time strongly suggesting that June make a donation to the organization. The episode begins with Neil and June sitting on a bench at the park, and they are watching June's granddaughter, Samantha, play soccer. Neil comments that you can't really tell she's sick, and June says, well, she's having one of her good days. And then June goes to tell Neil that Samantha has been taken off the kidney donors list, and Neil asks, how can he help? Next, we are at the Burke home, and we see that Neil has just invited himself in.
Morning, Neil.
Hope you don't mind. I let myself in.
I mind. You guys having breakfast?
Yeah, we're having breakfast.
Yeah.
It's a crazy ritual I'm sort of fond of. See, every morning I sit at my dining table, my lovely wife and my delicious cereal, and no thoughts of Neil Caffrey.
He says it has a free sheriff's badge. Did you get it already?
I'll do something.
Do you want a bowl with that cereal?
Thank you. Manners.
It's not what I had in mind. Why are you here?
I'm here because of June.
June owns the house Neil lives in.
I know who June is.
Her granddaughter needs a kidney.
But she was bumped from the transplant list last week.
Why?
I don't know. But a few days ago, a woman approached June and said her organization could help find a kidney for her granddaughter. She asked for a donation of $100,000.
$100,000. Look at you bringing me a case.
Well, it's what us lawmen do.
Okay, I'm interested. Talk to June, get me specifics.
So I can run with it.
Run with it? No, Barney Fife. No, you can walk very slowly, as long as you don't interrupt my breakfast again.
Gotcha. Enjoy your meal.
Now, this raises so many questions. First of all, why would somebody be bumped from a kidney donation list? It doesn't really seem to make sense. If they are in medical need, why would they get bumped? Well, according to the United Network for Organ Sharing, which is also called UNOS, and who is the private nonprofit organization that manages the nation's organ transplant system under contract with the federal government here in the U.S., there are multiple transplant centers around the country, and each one can set its own guidelines for transplants. Even though each transplant center can set its own guidelines for transplants, there are some requirements that seem to be pretty much standard across the board. One of those is that the prospective recipient undergo an evaluation consisting of medical and psychological tests. Now, the evaluation lets the doctors determine if the patient is healthy enough to get the transplant. Some of the tests required to ensure the health of the patient would include things like blood tests, urine samples, chest x-rays, blood pressure readings, cancer screenings, and things of that nature. Now, there may also be other tests required depending on the health and age of the potential recipient. The evaluation also includes talking with a social worker or financial counselor about the cost of the transplants and if the patient can cover them. Now, while they are on the wait list, patients will be required to go to a transplant center typically once a year for testing. Now, these would be the same tests that they had to go through to get on the list in the first place. And these tests, these additional tests, are not optional. They are required in order to stay on the list. So, based on the information I was able to find, there doesn't seem to be any reason why someone would be taken off of a transplant list and not know why. The presence on the list, once you're qualified, is maintained simply by going to your annual visits or your required visits for follow-up evaluations and health checks. Now, that's something that somebody would know if they didn't do. So if you didn't do it and you got disqualified off the list, you would know that. You would understand the reason. I suppose it's possible that in some cases somebody might be taken off the list for financial reasons, although I'd mentioned UNOS, which is the private nonprofit organization that manages the organ transplant system. Part of their responsibility is to monitor every organ match to ensure that policies are followed. And part of those policies are only medical and logistical factors are supposed to be used, and personal or social characteristics such as status, income, or insurance coverage are not supposed to play a role in the transplant priority. I would imagine there are resources available to help somebody cover the costs and organizations that help deal with the financial issues surrounding transplants. But in this case, we know that June is fairly well off, and I can't imagine that she would let her granddaughter get off the list simply because of financial reasons. So I think we can discount that as a possible reason. Well, combine that seeming inexplicable removal from the list, basically contrary to the set procedures, combine that with the request for a donation of $100,000, and you start to get a picture. And the explanation for that picture is that somebody involved at the transplant center or involved with the list for this particular transplant center, determining who will be on the list, who will not be on the list, somebody is using this list to make money. Now, you can't legally sell a kidney in the United States and probably in most places as well. You can't legally sell them. So if you can't legally sell them, then the organization that approached June can't legally solicit payment for a kidney for the granddaughter. They can't say, hey, you know, give us X number of dollars and we will give you the kidney. That would be selling it. So what they do is they say, hey, we can get you a kidney. Make a donation. And I guess if you call it a donation, even though you made it fairly obvious that there's a connection between the donation and getting the kidney, it may be technically legal. Borderline, certainly sleazy, but at least maybe legal. So somebody is doing something underhanded here. That's the only reason that I can think of at this point why Samantha would have been taken off the list. Somebody saw that June was wealthy and thought that they could exploit that for financial gain. Back in the episode, we are at Neil's apartment. Neil and Mozzie are discussing a plan to get some specifics about what the organization is asking of June. Mozzie clearly knows Neil well enough to know that he's embellished Peter's instructions. Neil tells Mozzie that Peter told him to run with it. And Mozzie, of course, questions it and says, oh, those were his exact words, run with it? And when Neil says, well, more or less, Mozzie says, yeah, I'm assuming less. We find out that Neil has set up a meeting with the charity's representative, Melissa Calloway, and he is posing as June's financial advisor. Mozzie seems to have some reservations about the situation. First of all, starting with the name of the charity, Hearts Wide Open, which he likens to the title of a horror movie. And then his reservations are increased when she arrives, and she drove there, And he sees that and he says, a New Yorker who doesn't take the subway is not a New Yorker you can trust. Of course, Neil points out that he doesn't take the subway either. And Mozzie smugly says, precisely. Now, when Melissa Calloway is getting out of her car, Neil sees that she left her briefcase in the car and he asks Mozzie to break into it and steal it. Steal the briefcase, not the car. Mozzie, understandably, doesn't like the plan. He says, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There's a reason most crimes happen at night. People can't see you. So since Mozzie's not going to do it, Neil seems to think that his only option is to do it himself. And so he insists that Mozzie take over the role as June's financial advisor and meet with Melissa Calloway while Neil himself breaks into Melissa Calloway's car. Neil goes down onto the street and starts to break into the car. But in the reflection of the door window, he sees a police officer approaching. He quickly improvises that he's the owner of the car, has locked his briefcase inside, and doesn't have the key because his wife took it. The officer is understandably suspicious, or at least not willing to accept the story at face value just because somebody tells him a story. So Neil tries to sell it by saying that he's an attorney in the prosecutor's office who needs to get to court to prosecute someone who hit a cop during a domestic disturbance. That seems to be the thing that pushes it over the edge for the cop. He decides to go ahead and buy the story and assist Neil in getting into the car. And meanwhile, Mozzie and June meet with Melissa Calloway in Neil's apartment.
But going around the National Registry, isn't that illegal?
Only if money exchanges hands. We find owners willing to contribute through the Good Samaritan law.
A donation is what helps to move things along.
We would never discourage anyone from helping us continue our work.
How much is a typical donation?
It varies.
Ballpark it for me.
Anywhere from 100,000 to half a million.
How much time do we have to consider?
Not much, unfortunately. There are only so many willing donors. And there are many people in difficult situations.
Well, that went about as well as could be expected. After all, Mozzie does admit that he is not a people person. And Mozzie seems to have difficulty keeping the conversation somewhat coherent while simultaneously trying to keep an eye on the security camera monitor that shows Neil interacting with the cops down around Calloway's car. Now, Calloway, during the conversation, is very cagey with her words. She says, well, our organization saw what happened to Samantha. Bureaucracy often gets in the way of compassion. The implication here is that a cold, heartless bureaucracy did this to Samantha, but her agency that she represents doesn't let bureaucracy interfere. And of course, the purpose of the statement is misdirection. It's to get June and Mozzie's attention on how the charity supposedly cares more about people than a bureaucracy. And so ignore the questionable things that might follow. Mozzie says, well, isn't going around the National Registry illegal? And she says, well, only if money changes hands. Well, the implication is that no money is changing hands. The statement that Calloway makes linking donations to finding a kidney for a transplant, the implication there is pretty clear that it is a pay-for-play situation. And the statement that Calloway makes later really kind of emphasizes the link between the donation and the receiving of the kidney, which really pushes it right up to the edge of legality. When Mozzie says, how much time do we have to consider? Calloway says, not much, unfortunately. There are only so many willing donors, and there are so many people in difficult situation. So the implication there is, if you don't make a donation, well, you know, somebody else is going to get priority. That's pretty much a blatant statement that they want June to buy a kidney for her granddaughter. They don't use the word buy. They don't use the word sell. But when you directly tie like that, the receiving of a kidney to the making of a donation, yeah, it's pretty much a done deal. It's a sale. So as I said, Calloway's comments about bureaucracy and compassion are just intended to get the target of their scheme to ignore the legal implications. The meeting between Mozzie and June and Melissa Calloway breaks up. But Mozzie can see that Neil is still in Calloway's car, so he tries to buy some more time by doing what Neil's instructions were. Do what I do. Mozzie seems to think that would be to ask Calloway out for dinner. But rather than slowing her down, it merely makes her all the more eager to leave. Later in the FBI offices, Peter and Neil are discussing the case. Peter says that Calloway works for the charity's founder, Dr. Wayne Powell, and Neil contributes a fudged version of his story, telling Peter that he, not Mozzie, talked to Calloway and got some names. But he admits that what he has isn't admissible in court. Peter, realizing that Neil's probably cut some corners, tells Neil a story about a former confidential informant of his named Jimmy Berger. Seems Jimmy Berger got cocky and got killed for sticking his nose into places where it didn't belong. And he warns Neil that Jimmy Berger is an example of what happens when you try to run the show on your own. And of course, as soon as Peter gets done telling Neil the story and tells him don't try running the show on your own, it becomes apparent that Neil was trying to run the show on his own. Jones comes up, tells Neil that, hey, I've got that info on those names that you wanted me to track down. Peter just kind of shakes his head and says, like, it's like talking to a wall. Now, all the names that Neil gave Jones to run down are doctors associated with a group called Doctoral Global Initiative, or DGI, which apparently provides medical services in third world countries. Neil suggests that this might be how Powell is finding organs for donation, but it's all still circumstantial. Peter says that they need to talk to Powell. Neil says he knows where to find the doctor because he saw an invitation in Calloway's car to a private tennis tournament at the Westside Tennis Club at Forest Hills. Later at the tennis club, there is a momentary hiccup when the doorman refuses them entry without an invitation, but Neil spots Calloway and charms and scams his way in, or their way in, but they both have to pretend that they are doctors with DGI. Neil seems to catch that Calloway is focusing most of her attention on Peter. He teases Peter that he'll have to flirt with Calloway the rest of the day, which should give him a fun story to share with Elizabeth over breakfast the next day. Inside the tennis club, Peter and Neil exchange a few barbs, and then they work separately on Calloway and Powell. Peter offers Calloway a drink, and she offers to show him where she wants him to work for the day. Neil begins chatting up Powell, dropping the name Doctoral Global Initiative. Unfortunately for Peter, Calloway seems to have a thing for married men. Or, as she puts it, she likes men with a little more experience and commitment. And since he made the mistake of telling Calloway that he was a chiropractor, she asks him to work on a knot that she says she has. In her back. Her low back. Her very low back. While she's flirting with Peter, along with her comment that his working on her back may be working on the wrong side, it seems that she may be actually trying to seduce him inside a tent in the middle of a tennis club, which seems an unusual place to try to seduce someone. But anyway, the discussion moves around to her work, and she mentions the Hauser Clinic. Peter plays along and says, oh, he's always wanted to check out the Hauser Clinic, and Calloway writes her personal phone number onto a business card and slips it into the inside pocket of his jacket. And she says, give me a call when you're ready. There's a statement fraught with double meaning. Well, as I said, while Peter is in the tent with Melissa Calloway, Neil is talking to Dr. Powell.
Doctoral Global Initiative is one of the few charitable organizations I still respect.
Is that why you found it Hearts Wide Open?
One of the reasons.
What can I get you?
Cranberry juice. You know, perhaps you can help me. I've got what you, you might call a friend in need. See, his remaining kidney is highly sensitized. PRA is through the roof. What he needs is a zero mismatch.
Perfect compatibility is rare.
I'm hopeful. There's a village on the outskirts of Manipur. Genetics of the population show some promise.
India. I travel there often. It's unfortunate the locals can't legally sell you what you need. Both parties would win.
My friend would agree with you. Tell you what, why don't you give me a call whenever you find yourself there? We make exceptionally charitable donations.
Well, that conversation was loaded with things being said that weren't being said outright. Powell uses the I've got a friend approach to tell Neil, who of course has introduced himself to Powell as a Dr. Leonard Parker. Essentially, Powell admits that he needs a kidney and that he has his eyes set on the population of a village on the outskirts of Manipur, India, as a source of what he needs, a zero mismatch kidney. Neil plays along, saying that he goes to India often, but that it's unfortunate that the legals can't legally sell Powell what he needs because everyone would win. Powell says his friend would agree, so why doesn't Neil slash Parker give Powell a call next time he finds himself in India? He also says Hearts Wide Open makes exceptionally charitable donations. And so again, we are seeing the word donation used as basically a substitute or a code for we're going to buy what we need. And we're going to basically violate the law, but we're going to play like we're complying with the law by calling it a donation and not a purchase. The idea is, of course, that he would pay Neil or Parker for a matching kidney, regardless of what he does or how he has to get it or do it in order to get the kidney. Now, during the conversation, Powell mentions that his friend, or himself, his PRAs are through the roof. A PRA is a panel reactive antibody measurement of anti-human antibodies in the blood. A PRA score is expressed as a percentage which can range from 0 to 99% that represents the likelihood that a person's blood would have an antibody that would react against a particular donor. A PRA of 20% means that you have antibodies to approximately 20% of the population. Having antibodies against foreign tissue makes it difficult to find a compatible living or deceased donor kidney. Now, the zero mismatch that he mentioned, according to the Very Well Health website, that is with regard to something called human leukocyte antigen typing, or HLA typing, or HLA matching, and is a kind of genetic test that is used to identify certain individual variations in a person's immune system. The process is critical for identifying which people can safely donate bone marrow, blood, or organs to a person who needs a transplant. HLA system refers to a group of related genes that play an important role in the immune system, and together the proteins made from these genes form something called a major histocompatibility complex, or MHC. These proteins are attached to almost all the cells of the body, excluding the red blood cells. They give an analogy that says you could visualize HLA proteins as different colored strings floating off of a cell. In that example, an individual's own cells are programmed to recognize a certain pattern of string colors that belongs to them. So, for example, if a person's HLA type includes a green string, a bright blue string, a light violet string, and a yellow string, and the immune system notices a cell with an orange HLA protein string, it would send off alarm bells because orange is not in the color types that it's looking for. The alarm would send a warning to the cell that it might be seeing something potentially dangerous, like a virus, and this might trigger the immune system to attack the cell. Now, the HLA system plays an important role in the immune defense system. However, it also helps determine who can give and receive tissue successfully. If the immune system targets the donated tissue as foreign, it may attack and damage the donated tissue. So that's why it's important for people to receive donated tissue that has as many matching HLA proteins, or the right colors, as possible. And this is where we get into the zero match, or zero mismatch. The doctor needs to have somebody who is all the same colors that he is, basically. Now, after Neil and Peter have completed their respective tasks of interviewing the two different people there, Neil spots Peter walking out of the tent behind Melissa Calloway, who appears to Neil, at least, to be getting dressed after having been, presumably, at least somewhat undressed. And he gives Peter a slightly shocked look, I guess. He's certainly surprised. But Peter sees the look and he shakes his head as if to say he can't believe Neil would think what he seems to be thinking. Later, back in the office, Neil starts giving Peter a bad time, asking if Elizabeth knows that FBI actually stands for Female Body Inspector. And of course, Peter doesn't appreciate it, tells Neil to sit down and shut up. Then he starts going over what he found out and what their problems are with what he's found out. Powell's been flying to India a lot, but Peter can't arrest him for building up his air miles. It's impossible to prove that Powell's been using DGI doctors to scout out donor organs because the charity masks their work as volunteering, and all the funds that pass through it are tagged as charitable donations. Of course, it seems to all come together and make sense to Peter because Powell was born with just one kidney and it's failing, and the charity gives him the perfect cover to be able to go outside the system and the law using DGI doctors to try to find a donor organ for himself. It all makes sense, it all fits on paper, but it's all just theory because they have no real evidence. So Peter tells Neil that he's certain that they can get the evidence that they need if they could get inside the Hauser Clinic, but they can't get in because of doctor-patient confidentiality restrictions. Back in Neil's apartment, Mozzie is contemplating a chest layout, which Neil identifies as Byrne versus Bobby Fischer, 1956. Now, that's a reference to what Austrian-American international chess master champion, journalist, and author Hans Mach. Kamach? I don't know how to pronounce it. It's K-M-O-C-H. He wrote for Chess Review, and he dubbed that particular game, Byrne versus Bobby Fischer, the game of the century. The game pitted 13-year-old future world champion chess player Bobby Fischer against Donald Byrne. At the time, future world champion Bobby Fischer was a promising 13-year-old junior facing his first real test against master-level opposition in the form of 26-year-old international master Donald Byrne in the Rosenwald Memorial Tournament at the Marshall Chess Club in New York City on October 17th of 1956. In addition to calling the game of the century, Kamach said that the game was a stunning masterpiece of combination play performed by a boy of 13 against a formidable opponent, and said it matched the finest games on record in the history of chess prodigies. Back in the episode, it turns out that Mozzie is in a funk. The charity has rescinded its offer to June's granddaughter. Mozzie also tells Neil that the people at the clinic have been spooked and that they've been getting rid of files, but that the private security there prevented him from finding out what the files were. Over at the Burke residence, Elizabeth finds Melissa Calloway's card and personal phone number on the card in Peter's jacket and confronts him about it.
Honey?
Yeah?
What is this?
I was going to talk to you about that. That is part of an undercover job I was working. And part of the cover was that I had to talk to another woman.
You must have been quite the conversationalist.
I had a flirt with her, so Neil could get closer to the target.
Isn't it usually the other way around?
Yeah, she chose me.
You had to seduce another woman?
No, I had just had drinks with her. Nothing happened, Al, I swear. Are you laughing? You're laughing. You know that?
You had to flirt? You hate flirting.
I know, and now I remember why.
What did you say to her?
I said that she looked thirsty. It worked.
Oh, please tell me there's surveillance video of this. I gotta see this.
In watching this, to begin with, it seems like Elizabeth is upset. And to me, it seemed like she might just be on the verge of crying. But then she starts laughing. And she really seems to stick it to Peter here because she finds the whole idea of Peter flirting hilarious. Even more so that he might have been successful at it. Even Peter seems a bit embarrassed by the situation and his apparent success and the fact that he remembers why he always hated flirting. And of course, this is a nice callback to the episode, The Portrait, where Peter and Elizabeth are discussing flirting and Peter's lack of ability.
The thing about Neil... nothing is ever what it seems. Guy's a contradiction. He's obsessed about Kate, but you should have seen him flirting with this girl at the takedown.
But honey, that's who Neil is. That's never gonna change. That's what I love about you so much.
What? That I lost all ability to flirt when we got married?
Honey, it was even questionable then.
It was.
So when you think on that conversation back in The Portrait, it really makes Elizabeth's astonishment even more apparent and more understandable because Peter can't flirt. He hates flirting. He's a lousy flirt. And it didn't even work with Elizabeth when they were first getting together. So the fact that it worked with Melissa Calloway is astounding to Elizabeth. And of course, as Elizabeth is telling Peter that she hopes there's surveillance video on the flirtation, the phone rings and it's Neil.
Hey, it's me. I'm just wondering if you looked into that clinic yet.
I had the Bureau put in a request for their financial records. Why?
No, I'm just checking. Thanks.
Why is Elizabeth laughing?
No idea.
Talk to you later.
The FBI asked for copies of their financial records.
That explains it. I'd be doctoring my books right now, too.
We have to get into their clinic. See what they're trying to get rid of.
Have a plan?
Why did Peter do that? Well, I mean, we know why he did that, but in a bigger sense, why did he do that? He should have known that the clinic would have taken some sort of action to prevent Peter and the FBI from getting the financial information that they were looking for. It would have tipped them off that there's something that somebody's looking into and we need to cover our tracks. And the situation is really not that different than it was in the episode Hard Sell. And if you remember there...
We know who we're after. Now all we need is proof that Avery is getting a cut of the profits in the room.
Well, can we get the boiler room books?
Now we make that request, we tip our hands, and they close shop. Now we need another way in.
So Peter's been in this situation before, and he knew in that previous episode, Hard Sell, what the outcome would be of them requesting the books. So what was different about this situation that apparently led Peter to believe that they could request the books from the charity without the charity reacting as they did? Did he miscalculate that badly? Or was someone else responsible for the decision? And he just kind of said, well, you know, I made this request, or yeah. No, he made that request. He said he made that request. So I don't know why he did that if he understood that making this sort of request would elicit a negative response. Maybe he just figured that they wouldn't make the connection because there was no reason for them to make a connection at this point because there was no indication that anybody had any questions. I don't know. But it was clearly a bad decision on Peter's part. Here, Neil and Mozzie decide to infiltrate the charity's offices by having Mozzie pretend to be a nutcase who seems to believe that he's Bruce Willis while he randomly quotes lines from various Bruce Willis movies. Well, the plan seems to work, at least initially. They get past the keepers in the lobby and up to the second floor where Mozzie snags a cart full of files and Neil breaks into the office of Dr. Powell. What Neil didn't bother to do when he went in was to check for any sort of security. And as a result, he's seen on security cameras and soon Neil hears security personnel being called to that office. He hurriedly scribbles on a document and tries to fax it to Peter, but security people arrive and cancel the fax mid-transmission, or stop it mid-transmission at least. The security people call Dr. Powell, and he seems to give the security folks the impression that Neil is probably just one of the mental patients from the clinic. But then he tells security to sedate him, which seems to make clear that he believes that there's more to the situation than that, which would make sense since the FBI had already tipped their hands by making the records request. Now, unfortunately for the security people, a portion of the fax did make it through to the fax machine at the Burke House. And Peter realizes that Neil is in trouble when Elizabeth reads what Neil has scribbled across the face of the page that he was trying to fax, which is the name Jimmy Berger.
Electronic Monitoring Compliance Unit.
This is Burke, FBI. I need the location of Detention Tracking Anklet 9305 Alpha, Neil Caffrey.
One moment, please.
Is Neil in trouble?
Yeah, he's in a lot of trouble. Caffrey, I told him not to go to that clinic. I told him. But he's Neil. He doesn't think. They're going to send him back to prison for this. What I have to do is call Judge Chivarot and get a warrant.
I mean, why don't you just get somebody to, I don't know, show you the place? If she invites you in, that's okay, right?
I've said in the past that I don't believe that Neil is a good planner, in the sense that he doesn't look beyond the moment and the next step and doesn't consider the consequences of how what he does impulsively to solve an immediate and short-term problem will complicate the goal of achieving the longer-term plan and the ultimate goal. And here Peter essentially says the same thing. He says, I told him not to go to that clinic, but he's Neil. He doesn't think. Peter is clearly and understandably upset. He starts ranting about having to go to a judge to get a warrant. Now, I initially thought that Peter wouldn't necessarily have to do that. After all, exigent circumstances. Remember that ploy from the pilot episode? That seemed to give him grounds to enter a building in that episode. So why not here? I don't know. The only reason I can think of would be that somehow the clinic is within Neil's 2-mile radius. And so that doesn't in itself warrant using exigent circumstances to enter the clinic. Or perhaps Peter realized he couldn't pull that trick again. He had done it one time. Maybe he got his hand slapped. Maybe he realized that he had been pushing it on that and didn't want to try to repeat the trick because it would raise too many eyebrows. Whatever. For whatever reason, he can't use that trick. So he's got to get a warrant. Or so he thinks. But here, once again, we see that Elizabeth demonstrates her value to Peter's career when she suggests a quick and legal way to bypass the bureaucratic process of gaining entry to the clinic. Hey, have somebody invite you in. You've already got an invite, so just take advantage of it. But of course, that phone call and conversation with Melissa Calloway doesn't go quite as smoothly as expected, either for Peter or for Elizabeth.
This is Melissa.
Hey, Melissa.
This is Dr. Tenenbaum from the tennis club. How are you?
Actually, I'm going into the office for Dr. Powell.
Perfect. You said I could swing by anytime, and I'm going to be in the neighborhood.
Oh, I'm sorry, but today it's not looking good.
Tell her you need to see her. Tell her you can't stop thinking about her.
This is a test, isn't it?
Doctor, are you there?
Yeah.
I need to see you. I can't stop thinking about you.
Is that right? Okay, compliment her. Tell her that you've never met someone like her. You're intrigued.
I've never met someone like you before.
I'm intrigued.
Well, I'd be lying if I said I didn't miss those magic hands of yours.
Magic hands?
I was a chiropractor.
Really?
Doctor?
Yes.
I've got to run. But if you're really interested in seeing the clinic today, I can get you a pass. You can come by later, we can grab a drink.
Perfect. That was definitely a test.
Yeah, maybe Peter should have mentioned the bit about pretending to be a chiropractor and the bit about the magic hands earlier. I suspect he's going to pay for that oversight later, because clearly Elizabeth was not happy to hear that. Next, Peter arrives at the clinic, but Calloway tries to put him off. She had already told him that it wasn't a good time. So it's not surprising that she would put him off, but while she takes a phone call from Dr. Powell, Peter takes the opportunity to slip into the building. Peter finds Neil in an office, restrained and drugged. Peter releases Neil, and the two of them stumble their way out of the office and into a conference room.
I cannot believe you. Why would you do something like this?
Peter, I've done so many worse things you don't even know about.
Just shut up. Look what things.
You remember the ENIAC manuscripts?
You took those? How?
Carrier pigeons. Think about it.
Who cares? Peter, it's not what's important. It's not about money. It's about people.
Good, because you're going to be spending a lot of quality time with people in orange jumpsuits once I get you out of here.
Right. Going down once they see those security tapes of me, break it in here.
Those surveillance cameras.
And before I go back, you should know this. Out of all the people in my life, Mozzie, even Kate, you know, you're the only one.
The only one what?
The only person in my life I trust.
Don't pick this.
I could slip you off, that wouldn't be picking. That'd be slipping. But...
what is that?
Surveillance tape.
Here. Let's go.
You stole that from me?
Yeah, it's a regular Kodak moment.
It seems that his drug-induced state leads Neil to open up with several revelations, both personal and professional, because Neil doesn't seem to be the sort of person, at least in a normal state, to make such admissions willingly. We have seen him make admissions of his misdeeds to Peter in the past, but they were all made under some sort of duress, such as in the episode The Portrait, when he revealed to Peter that he had stolen the Halstenberg from Dorset's motel room. He only did that because Dorset had threatened Taryn Vandersant. So the admission about the Antioch manuscripts and Peter being the only person in his life that Neil trusts, but while Neil is clearly not in his right mind, I think these admissions are significant and sincere. And he seems to recognize the significance also of Peter's action of stealing the security camera tapes. That's a pretty big step for Peter. Back at the Burke home, Elizabeth is nursing Neil, who is dealing with his drug-induced hangover, but she's giving Peter the cold shoulder. She still apparently hasn't forgiven him for being Mr. Magic Hands, and I'm guessing that she won't forgive him for at least a bit longer than we will ever know. Peter and Neil review their position and the information they have. The result is that they are able to trace the four donors whose names came through on the facts that aborted facts that Neil tried to send to Peter, and they realize that Powell is using his charity to find and leverage financially distressed patients into being donors for Powell's wealthy clients, and that Powell is using DGI to scout the globe for possible kidney donors for himself, and is using money siphoned from Hearts Wide Open to finance his globe trotting to follow up on these possible donors in his effort to find his zero mismatch donor. Unfortunately for Peter and the team, the four donors whose names they have won't talk. When Peter asks for ideas from the other team members, the only hand that goes up is Neil's. After pointedly ignoring Neil, Peter finally calls on him, and Neil has an idea. Since they need to convince Powell to spend the money he's made from his illegal organ sales in order to bring him down, they just need to leverage him into spending it by enticing him with the one thing he wants: a zero mismatch kidney. They plot ways to convince Powell that his kidney is failing. They pick three symptoms: weight loss, skin irritation, and blood in the urine. The team executes their plan by swapping out Powell's suits for a larger size, which gives the impression of weight loss, by applying an irritant agent to his clothes, which simulates the skin irritation, or causes a skin irritation, though not by kidney failure, and also by injecting a chemical into his cranberry juice when it's being delivered, which causes his urine to turn red, which simulates the blood in the urine. The plan works, and Powell is convinced that the end is near. But then, a seeming miracle happens for Powell. Neil, as Dr. Parker, calls Powell and tells him, "Hey, I'm in India, and I've got good news." Well, Jones poses as a driver sent to pick up Powell for his trip to the airport. Powell takes his sleeping pill with the water that Jones offers him, which I'm going to guess has been laced with additional sleeping medication to ensure that the good doctor is completely out of it. When Powell wakes up, he finds himself in a room in what seems to be a makeshift hospital in India. Neil, as Dr. Parker, appears to give Powell the good, or not so good, news.
What happened?
You went into renal failure during your flight. You landed in Manipur. We had to remove your kidney and place you on dialysis. But your body isn't tolerating it. Your blood pressure is dropping.
Right? Oh, is the donor here?
He is. And he's curious about what kind of charitable contributions you can make to our clinic.
Well, that's not going to be a problem. I can get you $100,000 by tomorrow.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of $30
million. $30 million? Are you insane?
How much is your life worth to you, Doctor?
You're shaking me down.
I'm asking a question.
I can get you $2 million.
This isn't a negotiation. Paddy Chadika, this machine should be free in the next few hours.
Wait. I have an account. There's not $30 million in there, but it's close, right? I can have that money transferred anywhere you want.
That'll raise flags.
No. This account, it's completely secure. All right. You know, it was set up to siphon money from my charity. It was designed to be untraceable.
It's at New Reserve, 774-196B.
password cranberry.
Then I have what I want. Let's see how quickly we can get you healthy again.
Neil is essentially doing to Powell what Powell has done to others, extorting them for whatever he can get from them with their lives as the bargaining chip. And of course, it's done without actually demanding a dime, as it was done with Powell's charity. And it does seem to be a bit of poetic justice, a bit of a turnabout is fair play type thing. Now, the fact that Neil asks specifically for $30 million, that's an extreme donation. That's a huge donation. I'm guessing that that was also not just a shot in the dark number. I'm guessing that between the information the FBI got with their information request and that Mozzie found in the files that he had stolen in the cart from the clinic, that they had a pretty good idea of how much money Powell had embezzled from the charity. Probably not an exact figure, but they had a ballpark, and so that's, they probably figured that $30 million as the number was something that was not out of the realm of possibility for Powell. Powell agrees to the $30 million extortion, and he gives up his bank info, after which everyone seems to disappear. He discovers that the supposed IVs weren't even inserted into his arm, that the sounds of the hospital were just a recording, and then we see him walk out of the building where he discovers that he's still in New York, and he is confronted by FBI agents along with Peter and Neil. Later, Peter and Neil meet June at her granddaughter Samantha's soccer game, and they tell June the good news. Not only is Powell and his so-called charity out of business, but Samantha is back on the donors list and at her original spot. Peter leaves Neil and June at the soccer game and goes home to Elizabeth.
Hi there. Couldn't help but notice you were sitting alone.
Well, my husband's at work. It happens a lot.
He must be good at his job.
Well, actually, his partner does a lot of the heavy lifting.
Oh, really? If that's the case, I bet it's because your husband is distracted by thoughts of you.
Interesting theory.
Bet his favorite part of the day is coming home with that smile. Whoever he is, he's a lucky man.
I keep telling him that.
You look thirsty.
So that line does work.
Every time. By the way, I'm Dr. Tenenbaum, chiropractor. I'm told I have magic hands.
Okay, now you're dead.
Just a couple of reminders. You can help the podcast grow by telling a fellow White Collar fan about it. And on the website, which is at www.whitecollaredpc.com, you can find all the ways that you can contact me. And I will also be providing links to all the resources I've mentioned in the episode on the website, and I will also be providing show notes. Thank you for listening, and be sure to join me for the next episode as I share my thoughts on episode 11. Home invasion. Until then, take care and God bless.